Talk Show.
Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. And since everybody's already heard the rest of the greeting earlier with the other show, and in the interest of time, let's just get right into the topic. Mr. Fink, are you there, sir?
How you doing?
I'm well, yourself?
Great. Praise Yahweh.
Yes, praise Yahweh. And this will be as much a learning experience for myself as for the guests, most likely, since I have many questions, and I wonder, is it all right if we structure that? I ask a few questions, and you answer, and then expand and explain as you wish.
Well, I'm the guest, so I'll just go with the program.
All right. Well, first, could you give your overall, maybe a summary on any modern translations that you think are decent or worthwhile or even remotely useful? Are there any out there? If you had to say the most readily accessible modern translation, New Testament and Old Testament.
I have to be honest with you. I don't like any translations. I don't want to sound arrogant because I've got my own New Testament translation. But the first thing I would do when I pick up a new translation is I would check 1 Thessalonians 3:2 or Matthew 15:24 to 27 or certain key verses in Paul, like the end of 1 Corinthians or Romans chapter 8. And all of the modern translations have the same Christian Zionist mindset. You know, and they all defy the meaning of the Greek in order to keep the Jew-Gentile dichotomy, which the scripture does not reflect once you understand the context of the Bible.
I have noticed in translation, from going from translation to translation, they basically say the same thing, just using modernized words or slightly modified words, but they almost all look identical.
Right. And I can tell you what the worst translation is, the Living Bible.
Okay.
The Living Bible is absolutely repulsive because it just makes up a story, and it's loosely based on the New Testament manuscripts, but it's often saying the exact same different thing, the exact opposite thing that the Greek text says.
Right, well, how were these Bible translations? How did they arrive at these translations? What did they translate from? Where are the manuscripts or the text that they had access to?
Well, that's a long story, and we could start with the Old Testament if you'd like.
Okay.
The earliest Hebrew manuscripts don't exist; they're all gone. We have no early Hebrew manuscripts of the Old Testament. We have we have inscriptional evidence that supports that the Bible is as old as it claims to be. And in other words, a few years ago, they discovered the silver scrolls in Jerusalem, which are definitely from before 600 BC. And they contain bits and pieces of prayers from Deuteronomy, I believe. And we have other inscriptional evidence like that the Hebrew text is indeed very old and that Hebrew was the original language of the Old Testament. But we have no Paleo-Hebrew manuscripts whatsoever. The earliest Hebrew manuscripts we have are probably the Samaritan Pentateuch, and that's the only real text that we have in Hebrew or Aramaic or any similar Eastern language that's independent of the Masoretic text.
So they have no original Hebrew text for Genesis?
No original Hebrew text. We have the Dead Sea Scrolls now is the best thing that we have.
But we don't have direct access to those.
Well, you know, for a long time we didn't, and we don't have direct access to where we could go. I mean, the scrolls are very fragile relics, and for 25 years the Jews wouldn't let anybody touch them, but they were well studied from the very early 1950s, late 1940s when they were discovered. They were well studied. They were actually kept by mostly British and American scholars in a museum which was funded by the Rockefellers, which was on the west bank of the Jordan.
Mm.
And when in the 1968 war or 67 war, when the Israelis took over the West Bank, they shut that museum down and sealed, you know, they barred all comers from coming and examining the Dead Sea Scrolls. And they kept those scrolls to themselves for 25 years.
And
they opened them back up again to scholars in 1993.
And said that knowledge is power, so of course they want to limit our access to that knowledge.
Right, but a lot of people that are anti-Christian or anti-church, which isn't necessarily bad, but a lot of people that are anti-Roman church, they made claims during those 25 years that the Dead Sea Scrolls would have secrets revealed that would shake the foundations of Christianity and this and that. And they were all empty claims. Because the scrolls were, for nearly 20 years, they were given close inspection by scholars. They weren't all translated and they weren't all quite cataloged. But they did have scholarly inspection for a long period of time before the Jews were able to lock them up. There was one Catholic priest who's also a Harvard professor. His name is John Strugnell. And he made a claim, and it sounds like a legitimate claim. I mean, this guy's a pretty reasonable, educated man, that there was an entire Aramaic copy, an intact copy of the Book of Enoch in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And he saw them, and he studied them in the 60s, and he said that when the Jews opened up access to the scrolls again in 93, that version of Enoch was gone. And when he made that claim, he was excoriated by the academic community, by the Jews, and he was basically labeled an anti-Semite and drummed out of Dead Sea Scroll scholarship.
What would that have to do with anti-Semitism, though? I mean, his claim that Enoch was there and then someone removed Enoch.
Well, right, but obviously they were trying to hide something, and that's the way they silenced him. That's the way they silenced people. Clifton Emmeheiser actually wrote about that in a two-part series he wrote called Two Sea Lion and the Dead Sea Scrolls.
The implication for them claiming he's an anti-Semite is that something in the Book of Enoch teaches against Jews.
Right.
They don't like in the Book of Enoch.
Right. Well, Greg Howard would probably tell you that there's a lot in the Book of Enoch that teaches against Jews. But they're the Enochic writing definitely reveals two seed line. Hmm. And it definitely should have been considered a part of scripture by the Council of Nicaea, but for some reason I mean there were reasons, but that they didn't think that could coexist with the revelation of John. That in their meager understanding, they thought there were conflicts with the Book of Enoch, so they dropped it from Scripture. And I wouldn't doubt if that was if there wasn't some finagling behind the scenes to pressure some of those people to drop it.
So some evangelicals I've spoken with that claim every book that we need to be in the Bible is in the Bible, and the Bible is complete. They obviously lack a historical understanding of what went on behind the scenes determining what books were placed in the Bible.
Right, and not only that, they lack a historical understanding, period. The Bible itself is not a full revelation of the history of man. And in order to understand the Bible, it serves one very well to understand ancient history and the Bible's place in the ancient world and the place of the ancient Hebrew people and Israelite people in the ancient world. You can't understand, I mean, prophecy, for instance, is history written in advance. If it's not history written in advance, then it's not prophecy. So how could you possibly say that you could understand the Bible without history? Because I've heard evangelical ministers say or make the claim that all you need to ever read is the Bible. And that's, well, that might be good on the moral side of life, but it's not good in the general application of history and the application of biblical prophecy to the world.
So then you mean we need to read historical texts to determine the validity of biblical prophecy?
Absolutely. If you don't understand history, you'll never understand prophecy. So that's, most of these clerics don't understand history, and they're comfortable thinking that all biblical prophecy is talking about a seven-year period in the far-off, far-distant future. And they're comfortable with that because then they don't have to study history. They're absolved from doing any real work. The Dead Sea Scrolls are the earliest, and there are some Paleo-Hebrew scrolls, some scrolls, fragments that are Paleo-Hebrew, And the name Yahweh appears throughout, even, and there are some fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls that are actually from the Greek Septuagint. The Hebrews did not exist in a vacuum. And even those Greek Septuagint fragments do not have the word Kyrios. They have the word Yahweh in the places where it belongs. They have the Paleo-Hebrew written in Hebrew letters right in the Greek text. It says Yahweh right in the Greek text.
Our translations that we have today come from Greek copies or Greek translations that were from supposedly from the Hebrew manuscripts. People translated
them. Well, right. They're from the Masoretic text. Every modern Old Testament translation, unless it's a Septuagint, every modern translation of the Old Testament comes from the Masoretic text between the 6th and the 9th centuries. A.D., the rabbis, through several of their own Council of Nicaea-type situations, they had convened several of their own councils and decided upon a quote-unquote official Hebrew text, because there were a lot of divergences amongst the ancient Hebrew text by that time, just like we have divergences in different Bible translations in English today. They were actually, as time goes on and scribes copy scrolls thousands and thousands of times, they're going to make mistakes, and those mistakes are going to carry down into subsequent generations of scribes who write new scrolls. Because papyrus scrolls and parchment is a lot more durable, but papyrus is very fragile and it actually doesn't last very long.
I believe earlier you mentioned one specific mistake, that when it says thou shalt not abhor an Edomite, it should read Amorite, you said, and it was simply an issue.
Well, it should say Aramaean. It should say Aramaean, and it's simply an issue of it's, if you look in Strong's Concordance, you could see it at the block letter, Hebrew letter D, or the Daleth, and the letter R, or the Rosh, I think it's called. You'll see that those letters are very, very similar. And they're actually confounded or mistaken for each other quite often in Scripture. In the scribes that copied the Old Testament Hebrew from copy to copy, they actually screwed the D and the R up. They confused them quite often.
You said it was like the issue of the dot on an I, essentially.
It could be, because the D and the R are so similar that they're very easily mistaken.
Hmm.
And there's many places in Scripture where they're clearly confused. And in one place is Genesis chapter 10, where the word Dodanim appears in the King James Bible. And in the Septuagint and in some Hebrew copies, that word is actually Rodanim. And it means the Rhodian Greeks is who it means.
Hmm. Well, who would the Dodanim be?
Well, nobody. That's the point. But it says Dodanim in the King James, and it should be Rodanim, which is the Hebrew equivalent of the plural for the word Rhodian.
Dodanim is basically referring to a nobody group of people that don't exist.
Yes. So the rabbis, through several of their own councils, settled on a Hebrew text, okay, and this is probably around the 8th or 9th century A.D. that this happened. I'm sorry, I don't have Jewish history down like I have European history, but ultimately they actively sought to destroy all of the Hebrew, the different varying Hebrew texts, which did not meet their standards in the Masoretic text. And
right.
The earliest copies of the Masoretic text that we have are from the Nash Papyrus. Is we have a Nash Papyrus, which is probably close to Paleo-Hebrew, but we only have four fragments containing 24 lines of it.
All right.
And that includes part of the Ten Commandments from Exodus and a part of Deuteronomy. We have the Masoretic text, the earliest copies, are from the 9th century A.D. We have the We have a copy in the Karaite synagogue in Cairo, which is dated to 895 A.D., and we have other manuscripts that date to 856 A.D. and to the 10th and 11th centuries, and they're the oldest Hebrew Masoretic text copies of manuscripts that we have.
Now, these rabbis, how are they, you said they, there was behind the scenes basically subterfuge that enabled them to push these translations on Europe?
Well, I don't think that was subterfuge. It's hard to say for me. It's what we have is we have the Greek Septuagint.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, the Greek Septuagint is an Old Testament that was translated into Greek in the 3rd century B.C. And the Greek Septuagint was the Bible of the early church. No doubt about it. It all of the apostles, wherever they cite the Old Testament in the New Testament, the Gospels and the Epistles, they almost always quote verbatim from the Septuagint. There are very few quotes that look like they're based on the Aramaic Targums and somewhat more that are based on possibly a paraphrase of some Hebrew manuscript because they don't quite match the Septuagint. However, I'd say 75% at least of the quotes of the Old Testament found in the New Testament are right from the Septuagint.
And those are certainly valid then.
And that shows that the apostles understood the Greek Septuagint with all its flaws because it's not a perfect book. However, they understood that to be scripture. And they used it as scripture. And they used their quotes of the law and the historic books right from the Septuagint and the Psalms over and over again, verbatim from the Septuagint. I mean, there are many, many quotes in Paul right from the Septuagint where the quote in Paul varies but one or two letters. And entire paragraphs vary one or two letters from the copies of the Septuagint that we have today. And that's pretty amazing. And the Septuagint was actually scorned and scoffed at by the Jews for centuries, saying that it was a mistranslation, it was a bad translation. Because there are quite a few messianic prophecies. I mean, there's a lot of messianic prophecies as it stands in the King James Old Testament as we have it that are clearly messianic prophecies that we can understand. However, the Septuagint has many more. It has many more messianic prophecies in it. And those, a lot of those were removed by the Jews when they made the Masoretic text.
They don't want these messianic prophecies.
Absolutely not. And some of them were just outright removed. Now, the Jews scoffed at the Septuagint for the longest time and had Christian scholarship convinced, more or less, that the Septuagint wasn't really a valid book. However, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered and scholars began to make comparisons, it became obvious that the Septuagint and the Dead Sea Scrolls are closer to each other, much closer to each other, than the Masoretic text is with the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Hmm.
But I wouldn't throw out the Masoretic text for this reason. Even though it's a spurious text, it's undergone great redaction by the Jews, it's probably very little like what the original Hebrew text was. I can't throw out the Masoretic text for this reason, because every translation is by necessity so much an interpretation. And the books of the prophets are in some places, I mean, if you study Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 and the fulfillment of those prophecies, history played out in a lot of ways a lot closer to the way the Masoretic text reads. And I believe that that's because when the ancients had translated the Septuagint into Greek from Hebrew, that so much interpretation was necessary in the prophets. And it wasn't necessarily all correct interpretation. However, that we have the Masoretic text reserved to us through the Jews, we can examine that and have more insight. That's not a perfect picture either, but we could have more insight into what the original scripture said.
Right,
and because our copies of these scriptures are so far removed from the time of Moses and the time of David, I think that we shouldn't throw out any ancient witness. That somebody that really wants to study the Old Testament really has to read the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Septuagint, the Masoretic text translations, the the works of Josephus are very integral to understanding the Old Testament and any other ancient source he could get his hands on. That we need them all in order to gain glimmers of understanding.
Each one's basically a piece of the puzzle, and you can't just look at any one. You won't get a complete picture.
Exactly. Every paper that I have written, I've examined them all. I've examined all the translations. When I want to present a matter of, especially of doctrine from the Old Testament, I'm going to look at all those translations and see what they all say, because I don't want to look like the idiot that quotes the Masoretic text and quotes a verse that just isn't there in Josephus, the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Septuagint. Yeah, and assert a matter of doctrine over something that was probably a corruption. You have to look at them all. You have to study them all. They're all important.
I've seen your New Testament translation, but about the Old Testament, what would you recommend we do in regards for an Old Testament translation?
Well, I would not translate the Old Testament because the Masoretic text I esteem as corrupt, because the Septuagint, I'm not sure if it's 100% valid in the prophecies, and I don't think it's worth translating the Old Testament to make an effort to translate. I mean, this is my personal opinion of my own time. I'm not saying it's not worth it for somebody else to do. It's surely a noble cause. But to me, it was never worth it because the Septuagint is so far removed. Even at 300 B.C., it's not old enough to make me happy. You know what I mean? I mean, that's 400 years after the deportations of the children of Israel. And the Hebrew texts, they're just, I mean, to me, they're not worth it at all because they're all corrupted.
So the idea would be if somebody happened to find a Paleo-Hebrew complete Old Testament.
Well, yeah, of course that would be the ideal, but I don't know, you know, that would be, that's the Holy Grail. A Paleo-Hebrew Old Testament would be absolutely wonderful. There are people in identity like, I'm not going to be afraid to name names, like Scott Vaught, who claim to be Paleo-Hebrew scholars, but no Paleo-Hebrew biblical texts exist. So I don't know how they make that claim to be Paleo-Hebrew scholars.
And if they were to find a Paleo-Hebrew Old Testament somewhere in Palestine, the Jews would certainly immediately seize it, wouldn't they?
Oh, yes, they wouldn't let it go until they examined every word of it. And then if they didn't like what they see, they probably wouldn't let it go. But I'm sure they'd destroy it first. Now, we have there are other avenues into investigating the ancient scriptures. We have a lot of apocryphal literature. A lot of that literature was accepted as scripture by the New Testament writers. And we have the Aramaic Targums. Now, the Aramaic Targums, they were preserved in the Talmud. And we know the Talmud's evil. There's no doubt that it's not one of the most evil books in the world. It's a totally antichrist book. However, the Jews happened to preserve certain Aramaic Targums in the Talmud. And they also give us some insight into what people 2,000 years ago thought about the scripture. And the Targums had a legitimate beginning. That they had a necessary beginning, and it's even mentioned in the book of Nehemiah that by the time the return from Babylon happened, the common people did not properly understand the Hebrew tongue, and therefore they needed interpretations of the scripture read to them in the synagogue or in the assembly hall, and those interpretations are called Targum. And from there, we have the Aramaic Targums, which were eventually recorded, and they were preserved in the Talmud.
Is the reason given for why they no longer understood the language?
Well, I mean, if you look at the change in English, not so much in this country in the 200 years or in the last 100 years. I mean, it's been a sharp change. Most kids today wouldn't understand a lot of people that spoke in the 1830s and 40s. Because the English is so different. However, in the 70 years from the time the children of the children of Jerusalem, I'll say, because they weren't really the children of Israel. They were only the remnant of Jerusalem, went to Babylon into captivity. And that 70 years, which is two or three generations, they went from speaking Hebrew to speaking Aramaic or Chaldean, which is a totally different dialect of Hebrew. And when they came back, most common people only spoke Aramaic. So they needed, they began to lose the sense of many of the Hebrew words that were in the scripture. And they needed interpretations. And those interpretations are called Targum. And they were, I'm not saying that the Targum that we have in the Talmud are by any means the original Targum as the scripture was interpreted in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. Don't get me wrong, it's not. However, they are another way to examine what people believe the scripture said at the time of Christ, because some of the Targums are almost that old. So the Old Testament, we have a lot of problems studying the Old Testament. And what I recommend to people more than anything is that the Old Testament has to be looked at through the lens of the New Testament, because nobody since the time of David understood the Old Testament as well as the New Testament writers.
So when do you think this translation issue of Jew-Gentile, when did this first spring up?
Well, that sprung up this is a complex question. Paul was the apostle to the ethnoi, meaning the nations. That's the Greek plural word for nations. Okay? Paul was not the apostle to non-Jews, because he never used the term Jew. He used the term Judean, and he used the term Judean, as he himself explains in Romans chapter 9, of both Edomites and true Israelites who inhabited the Roman district of Judea. That's the only way that Paul used the term, is from those Judeans and the dispersion of those Judeans, because there was a dispersion of those Judeans throughout all the major cities of Rome, of the empire. And every, those people had to travel to do business, and they kept an assembly hall in every city, which served as an inn. It was an inn, and there's archaeological evidence of this in many places, that the Judean assembly halls were also inns, because the Judeans, when they traveled abroad, they had to go to a place that served food that was prepared in a way that was compatible to the Old Testament law. So they couldn't go to a Greek or a Roman tavern and spend the night and get a bed and breakfast there.
Through the dietary law issues, correct?
Right, because of the dietary law issues and because of other issues of communion that the Judeans had, where they wouldn't even sit at a table with non-Judeans. I mean, that was permeated throughout society. Mm-hmm. Now, all of these foreign assembly halls were they were operated by Judeans, and that's very clear. Every city that that Paul goes to in the Acts has a synagogue of the Judeans in it. And they always doubled as inns or taverns, or they were actually like a motel with a restaurant is today. That's what they were. The ancient world equivalent of that. So there was a pretty big dispersion of Judeans, and that was used, I believe, that was what Paul used, what Yahweh used as a stepping stone to reach the true dispersion of Israel, the dispersed Israelites, who were Romans and Greeks and Scythians and Celts. All those people actually did descend from the Israelites of the Old Testament. And there's no doubt. So those Judean synagogues spread throughout the oikoumene, or the inhabited world. They served as a stepping stone to bring the gospel to the nations that descended from Abraham.
People,
there's no doubt.
But they just didn't realize it.
Right. They didn't realize it, but Paul was telling them that that's who they were. And because they didn't understand the history, not having the science of archaeology that we had, Because it's 700 years between the time of Christ and the deportations of the Israelites. It's 1,100 years between the time of Christ and the fall of Troy, when the Romans left Troy and found, you know, founded the colony in Italy. I'm sorry, the Trojans left Troy and founded the colony in Italy that eventually became known as Rome. It's almost 1,200 years, actually. It's 1,100 years from the time that the Dorian Greeks leave Palestine to become Greeks, to become the Dorians of the Peloponnesus. That's a long time in history, 1,100 years. And when you don't have much recorded history to go on and no archaeology, I mean, how much does the typical American know about his own state here in America for the last 200 years? Nothing. The typical American knows nothing about what his own city was like 200 years ago or where his own family came.
So how do they know 1,100 years back?
Exactly. Most typical Americans don't know the names of all their great-grandparents. Just ask them. You won't find too many that can name their great-grandparents by name. And that's sad, but it's true. They don't even know what nationality they are, half of them. I ask guys all the time, what are you? And they're like, what do you mean? I said, well, you look German, but are you German or Irish? And they'll say, I don't know. Or they'll give me some other kind of vague answer.
Not a good answer.
No, and it happens all the time. So people, you know, they don't have a sense of history.
Well,
and these first century church people, they weren't college. They were normal, everyday people. And they didn't know, and they didn't understand. And we can understand today what Paul said. What Paul said is absolutely clear to me. And I believe that my papers on my site explain. I hope that they do in at least some degree. But Paul was going to, and he knew it, to the nations of Israel. However, those people were blind. And they all adopted Christianity over the next 1,000 years. But when they began to translate their own Bibles, they didn't know that they were actually the literal nations that sprung from Abraham's loins. So when they went to translate the Bible, they knew that they fit into the picture, but they didn't know how. So they actually had to universalize the text. They had to interpret the Greek text in the broadest sense possible so that they could fit themselves into the picture. So they created the dichotomy of Jew and Gentile out of the words that really mean Judean and nation. Now, I'm sure that the Jews themselves, the Edomites in Europe at the time, helped them with that because they claim to be Judeans, and they're not. They're not at all.
And they also claim to be Judah.
And people took that for granted that they were telling the truth. Now, history and scripture reveal that they are Edomites. However, all through the Middle Ages, Christians took it for granted that the Jews were telling the truth.
And the Jews, their own texts even admit that they are Esau. Am I correct that the rabbis will openly admit sometimes that they are Edom?
Well, absolutely. They can't. I mean, you can't refute the words of Strabo, the words of Josephus. They spell it out. And the New Testament spells it out. They're Edom. But scholars don't study. Most scholars don't study. I'm sorry, they don't. They think they're studied because they learn something, but that doesn't mean that they're really, independent learning. Most people go to school and learn what they're told and pass their exams. Most people don't go to school to learn on their own and find out about the material they're studying. They only want to pass their exam. And it was true 1,000 years ago, and it's true today.
So what do you think we should could do to correct this problem on an individual basis? What translations do you think we can rely on, if any?
Well, we can't. I wouldn't even tell anybody to rely on my translation. Open the books, look at the Greek, and let's talk about it. I'll defend my translation. Don't get me wrong. I just don't want people thinking that I'm saying that it's the end all to end all. It's not. I'm sure there's better scholarship that can be achieved. I'm sure I could do better. The manuscripts, we're always finding new papyri. the manuscripts can always be better. And you know, when I tried to use the oldest manuscripts that the King James does not use, the King James did not use the oldest translations of the oldest manuscripts available to scholars even at that time. It was Erasmus. Erasmus was a priest, a Catholic priest. He was clerically illegitimate. His father was a priest. Erasmus's father wasn't supposed to have children, and he did. And Erasmus was born in 1466. And he is primarily responsible for putting together what something that eventually became known as the Textus Receptus, or the received text. And that's the text that the King James and many other modern New Testament translations are based on. And Erasmus used manuscripts that dated from the 11th through the 15th centuries in his endeavor. Now, following Erasmus was a guy named Robert Stephanus. And Stephanus published four editions of Greek texts in the middle 1500s. Okay? And Stephanus's editions agitated the Roman Catholics.
What were his editions based on, though?
Well, he based his editions partly on Erasmus and partly on a slightly wider collection of New Testament manuscripts. Okay? And he put a lot of the alternate readings in the monuments. The oldest manuscript he used was probably the Codex Bezae, which is a 5th century great uncial, and it's named after a man named Beza. Okay? Now, Theodore Beza, the same time as Stephanus, roughly. Okay? Theodore Beza came to possess the Codex Bezae, and it's named for him. And the Codex actually was found by him in a monastery in northern France in Clermont. Okay? Now, the Codex Bezae dates to the 5th century, and I'll talk about it in a few minutes. Now, Theodore Beza, he made several New Testament manuscripts from these ancient codices. You see, the actual it requires an editor to create a Greek manuscript in a New Testament because they did not put any punctuation or separation in the letters to break it up into words when they wrote these ancient manuscripts, when they copied them down through the years.
Is it a means of saving space?
Yes, it was a means of saving space because paper and parchment, which is made from animal skin, are very expensive and difficult to create, and they squeezed as much text as possible on a piece of parchment or on a piece of papyrus when they copied it. They got everything they could onto it, so they put no spaces in sentences, no spaces between words. They wrote in block letters as tight as they could and wrote all the text out on the parchment, and it's very difficult to read. Now, I can sit and read Greek. I don't want to brag, but I can sit and read most of the Greek in the New Testament as quickly as I read English and translate it on the fly. However, that's because the words have been broken up into logical units, and there's punctuation and there's spaces. When there's no spaces and you have all that crammed together and you got to sit and think about where every word ends and begins, it takes me hours to read. It'll take me all day to read a chapter instead of 20 minutes. You know, it's a huge task breaking all that up into the logical words and sentences that we see on a page.
Are there any instances where there's maybe a discrepancy, the word could go one way or another depending on...
I do have several places in my Paul translation that I specifically remember where I give an alternate reading based on that. Right. However, the Greek language is a highly structured language, and there are only a couple of places in the New Testament where that would hinge on, that something important would hinge on that. And it's not a, you know, none of it would be a groundbreaking matter of doctrine, but there are a couple of places in the New Testament where you could read one way or the other based on the ending of the word that would matter somewhat, that would be significant.
How you want to group the letters, because you're saying that they were all just in one big block.
Right, exactly. However, you see, Greek had a lot of rules. no Greek word ends in a noun unless the noun is an N, an R, or an S. No Greek word ends in a T. No Greek word ends in an M or a B. So there are rules. There is a definite structure to the Greek language. Whenever you see the word dead, D-E, you'll note it. That's always the second word in a sentence. All the time. Guaranteed.
Do all the modern translations, do they observe these rules? Or they?
Well, yeah, they observe that. For the most part, they do observe the rules of grammar. But there are places in modern Bibles where the grammar is definitely defied. And one place I love to point out is 2 Thessalonians, I think it's 2 Thessalonians 3:2. You see, the Greek language is inflected, and by the inflections, we know the case of the nouns and the tense and person of the verbs and the person of the nouns. And the person of a word is whether it's singular or plural.
Yes.
And the case of a noun in Greek and in Latin and in German, it determines the noun's position in a sentence. Not the definite position as you'd write it, but the relative position. Is that noun the subject of the verb? Is it the object of the verb? Is it part of the predicate? Things like that. So if I have inflections on my words, like Greek does, I could write, Bill throws the ball, and it doesn't matter what order I write the words in. Bill is the doer of the action, and the ball is the recipient of the action.
So the same way in a number of other languages.
Exactly. If I write Bill in the nominative case and ball in the accusative case, the order of the words doesn't matter because Bill always throws the ball. The ball can't be throwing Bill. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, whereas when I studied Spanish and Latin, word order wasn't particularly important since every word ends in a certain fashion and that denotes whether that word is the actor or the actee.
Right. And 2 Thessalonians 3:2, the King James, the last six words of that verse are, for all men have not faith. And I can say with confidence that the word men is in italics and that is not in the original. But you also won't find the word have in that clause in the original Greek. It's not there. And it's not in italics in the King James.
So what does this mean in practical terms? What's the issue?
It says that the faith is not for all. That's what it says. And that's a big difference. And they actually flipped over the subject of the verb and added two words to it, but they only admitted adding one word to it.
So it looks like they're trying to say that not all men will have faith when it's really saying that the faith is not for all men.
Exactly. The faith is not for all. The faith is not for, that's exactly what Paul's saying. And the Greek, when you look at the Greek, it can't be interpreted fairly any other way. But they didn't understand it. They couldn't understand that.
Would be a universalist motive. Either they were looking at the Bible from a universalist perspective.
Well, they were absolutely. They were absolutely looking at the Bible from a universalist perspective because they had to. Because they had to fit themselves into the picture. And everywhere they did that. Every verse that could be taken universalistically, the King James translators took it universally. And all modern translators have followed in their path.
So who were the King James translators? I know it's the Authorized Version of King James of England, but who were the specific translators?
Well, it's more important to know who made the manuscripts. And this Theodore Beza, he had this Codex Bizae, which is a 5th century manuscript, and it has more variations in it than any of the other ancient manuscripts. Okay? There are, if you look at the Nestle Aland Novum Testamentum Graecae is what I use to make my translations with. And there are a half dozen codices, or better actually, that date to the 4th and 5th centuries AD that have been passed down through time. And the oldest of them are the Codex Sinaiticus, which dates to the 4th century, and the Codex Vaticanus, which dates to the 4th century. Now, the Codex Alexandrinus, the Codex Ephraim Syri, and the Codex Bazai all date to the 5th century. Now, amongst those five great uncials, they're called, they're the five major great uncials, the five real, and there are others. However, most of the others agree with one of these five or another. Amongst these five, the only one that went into the creation of the King James version of the Bible is the Codex Bazai. And it has a great number of departures from those other four codices, those other four ancient codices.
Why only utilize one out of five? Whose decision was?
Well, they just didn't have the others. They only had a whole bunch of later manuscripts, 10th and 11th century manuscripts that they used. And Erasmus admits adding things to the manuscripts or keeping dubious readings in the manuscripts because he thought they should be in there. Now, Stephanus built on what Erasmus did, and Theodore Beza built on what Stephanus and Erasmus did. And they used slightly different manuscripts in addition to what their forebears used in creating this Greek text that the King James would use. However, in addition to these fellows, okay, after these fellows had put their New Testament text together, there was a Dutch printing family named Elzevir. And the Elzevir family created a New Testament text based on the works that it was like an amalgamation of the works of all three of these gentlemen. And the Elzevirs, as an advertisement in the front of their book, called it the Textus Receptus. So the word Textus, the phrase Textus Receptus, which means received text, okay, actually started out as a printer's advertisement, as a printer's boast that that was the received text of the New Testament.
Essentially, you have a long line of people that make mistakes. They leave a text for someone else to come along and carry on, and they make more mistakes and just add to it, and you wind up with one big jarbled mess of mistakes.
Absolutely, and we come out with it, we end up with this thing that everybody thinks that because it's called the Textus Receptus that it's some sort of official Christian text, and it's really just a printer's advertisement.
So
that's it, and they did that in 1624. However, the King James was already translated. However, the Textus Receptus has been a critical factor in New Testament translation ever since, okay? Most of the other major translations of the Bible are based on the Textus Receptus, and the King James was based on a collection of manuscripts from the same people that the Textus Receptus came from.
So the King James only movement, they're inherently limiting themselves to a fundamentally flawed translation.
Right, because we have hundreds of Greek manuscripts that are much, much older than the ones the King James used. And these manuscripts, okay, let's take Mark 16:9-20. That doesn't exist in any manuscript older than the 5th century. And there are plenty of witnesses to the Gospel of Mark older than the 5th century that don't know anything about Mark 16:9-20. Now, Jerome, who translated the Latin Vulgate in the 5th century, he wrote that Mark 16:9-20 don't belong in the Bible, in the scripture. But Erasmus liked it and went against Jerome and included it. So we have it in the King James Version of the Bible because Erasmus made that decision. One person made that decision. And that's what the King James only people base their beliefs on.
So what one person 5 or 6 centuries ago decided, oh, I like this, I don't like that, that's what they want to go with.
Absolutely. That's right. Basically what happened. And there are many other scriptures that don't belong in the Bible. And there are probably, out of all the variations of the ancient manuscripts, I mean, the Codex Vaticanus and the Codex Sinaiticus, the oldest great uncials. And since then, we've also, the last 150 or so years, dug hundreds of Greek papyri out of the ground. And some of those papyri are actually pretty complete and pretty ancient. There is P45 and P46 are two ancient papyri that were found out of many. But these P45 contains a great amount of the text to the Gospels, and it dates to the 3rd century AD. The papyri, and that papyri is actually today in the Austrian National Library in Vienna. P46 is dated to 200 AD, and it contains much of the text of Paul's letters from Romans to Hebrews. And today it is housed in the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Okay? And it dates to 200 AD, and that's within 150 years of the writing of the first Gospels. So that's
why
pretty...
are people taking translations off of these?
Well, right. And I, in my, when I did my translation in the New Testament, I only used the great uncials from the 4th and 5th centuries AD, okay, and the ancient papyri that predated those. That's the only manuscripts I based my translations on. And I my notes are based on them also. But my notes aren't freely available on my website. And I laid aside all the newer manuscripts. So there's a lot of, John 7:53 to 8:11 is not in my John translation because it was not in any of those manuscripts. And the same thing with Mark 16:9 to 20. It's not in any of those manuscripts, so you won't find it in my Mark translation.
I imagine the Judeo-pastors would just say, oh, you're taking out of the book, just like Revelation 1.
Well, I took out of their King James, but I'm not taking out of the oldest manuscripts.
So you're basically just taking out things that other people added in for dubious reasons. But...
Well, absolutely. If you have 18 manuscripts, say, I'm just throwing a number out there, that date before the 6th century, that do not have a text in it, and you have a 9th century manuscript that has that text in it, how could you consider that text to be legitimate when 18 old manuscripts found in different places around the Mediterranean don't have that text?
Absolutely. So you're just taking out somebody else's edition that was an unfounded edition.
Well, I believe so, yes. And if I think there's any chance that the edition may have belonged, I put it in my notes. But some editions I don't even – Mark 16:9 is not even in – 9 to 20 isn't even in my notes. It doesn't warrant the mention.
So where does this Mary Magdalene story come from? Did someone just invent it?
Well, this is a whole different ballgame, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Alexandria in Egypt was they weren't all Edomites, but it was – there was a great Judean community in Alexandria. And it was, for the most part, a pretty scholastic community. But a lot of the people were Edomite Judeans and not real Judah Judeans. And that's evident. I mean, if you've ever read Philo, I read Philo, and it has Sigmund Freud written all over it. It is typical Edomite twisted Jew garbage, Philo Judaeus. Okay? And I couldn't even read the book. I read the first couple of pages, and I said, this is crazy. And I skimmed through parts here and there. And I threw the book back on. It was a book I had got from the library, and I threw it back on the shelf. I couldn't read it. And I have no problem reading any ancient book, no matter how dry it is. And I couldn't read Philo. It's straight garbage.
Say it's disgusting, try it.
In the 1st century and the 2nd century A.D., there was a group of Jews in Alexandria in Egypt that started a sect which is known as, today to us, as the Gnostics. Okay, and these Gnostics in the 2nd century set out to counter Christianity, and the Jews tried like hell to destroy Christianity at an early time, and they couldn't do it. So what they did was they learned to pervert it with false books, and they wrote the Gospel of Thomas, and they wrote the Gospel of the Hebrews, and they wrote the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. And they wrote the Gospel of Judas Iscariot, and they wrote a whole bunch of other crap, and it was all rejected by Christians in the second and third centuries. They all rejected it.
Because they recognized it as crap.
They absolutely recognized it as straight Gnostic garbage. Okay? So some of these scrolls that these Gnostics wrote ended up buried in the desert at Nag Hammadi. And for 1,800 years, the only way we knew about the Gnostics was through the little things that Irenaeus and Tertullian and other early Christian writers said about them. They were for the most part a mystery. Then, in the early 1900s, a discovery was made at Nag Hammadi, and these manuscripts were dug out of the ground, and lo and behold, certain people treat them as great newly discovered secrets. And the Gnostics have had a hell of a lot more success today perverting Christianity than they had 1,800 years ago. And that's the truth. So I do not accept the Gospel of Thomas. I do not, and there's elements of truth in all those Gospels, but they're all Gnostic documents, and they all are an attempt to universalize and pervert Christianity.
Or just distract us with issues that really we don't need to be dealing with because there's no basis for them. When they talk about, was Jesus married to Mary Magdalene, there's no scriptural basis for that. There's no biblical basis.
Well, right. And the real distraction, the real distractors, okay, are the Jews that are printing all the books and making all the movies about it that are trying to mislead Christians. That's the real distraction, are idiots like Dan Brown. They call, oh, this is absolutely true. And print a novel, and 18 million people buy it. I don't accept any of your Gnostic documents, and that's the reason why. But they can all be, you know, the perfection of Scripture is evident in the fulfillment of prophecy. And if you come along with some newly, greatly discovered secret mystery book that is going to shake the foundations of Christianity and whatever they claim about it, and you actually examine that writing in the context of the rest of the gospel, it'll prove every time, it'll prove itself that it's phony. There's no doubt in my mind. And the, you know, the evidence of the perfection of Scripture is definitely the fulfillment of prophecy. And Luke and Paul and many of the other Gospels prove that. Many of the other New Testament writings prove that.
I'm back. Sorry about that. I had a phone issue. It just booted me off. What were you starting to say now, sir?
Oh, I'm sorry. The proof of the New Testament, the veracity of New Testament writings is the fulfillment of prophecy.
Yes.
And when you come along, a book is suddenly discovered that goes against the grain of all of that writing, and it's supposed to be some newfound truth. If it goes against the grain of the entire Bible, it can't be true. And you have to examine past the publicity that it's getting. You have to examine deeper into it. And those Gnostic writings prove themselves false at every turn. None of them are legitimate. They're all first and second and third century forgeries.
Ultimately, the test of the validity of any scripture is the fulfillment of that scripture.
Absolutely.
Just like the Jews say that the protocols of Zion are a forgery, well,
they've all been fulfilled, so they can't be,
Absolutely. The ultimate evidence in favor of the protocols being genuine is their fulfillment.
Right. The exact opposite of what the Jews say about the Bible is true about the protocols of Zion. That's absolutely true.
So do you have any, we're coming up on the hour here, do you have any closing thoughts, sir?
Well, I just believe that people have to examine the foundations of Scripture and you know, these KJV-only advocates, they don't have a leg to stand on. When you actually examine the sources of the King James Bible and contrast that to the oldest manuscripts, there's a lot of problems in the translation, but there's also a lot of problems in the text that the Bible was taken from. And when there's problems there, it doesn't even really matter who translated it, because the foundation of the first premise is wrong. And people should examine the sources of what they are reading. Somebody in my forum posted a post to counter something I said and quoted Bullinger. And what he's countering my theology with something based on Bullinger, and Bullinger is an apologist for the Jews, and he's a Zionist. And he can't be a Christian. A Zionist can't be a Christian. I'm sorry. The two ideas are totally opposed to each other. You can't be a supporter and an embracer of the Jews and be a Christian. And what Bullinger was saying in his one quote that he gave was obviously a statement that placated the Jews. And that's not Christian.
Right. Well, do you have any recommendations for a historical text that we could find online or order and start reading in the next few days that would help enhance our understanding or appreciation?
Well, reading Tacitus is a good investigation into life in the first century and what that was like, but nobody can understand the intertestamental period properly without reading Flavius Josephus. And it's a long, hard read, but it's crucial, at least from book 12 to book 20 of Antiquities and the second book of the Wars, it's crucial to understanding the intertestamental period and the culture and environment of Judea at the time of Christ.
All right. Well, I'll keep those books and those authors' names in mind.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for the show. You've given me quite a lot to think about, and hopefully the guests have quite a lot to think about, and some questions have been answered, and new ones will come.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yahweh bless, sir.
Praise Yahweh.